Hello. This is Thursday, July 24th, Seattle, Washington. I'm talking to Mike Delaney, and we always start off these little things with a couple of simple questions, like your birth date.
September 24th, 1943.
And you were born in?
Concord, Massachusetts.
And what were your parents doing when you were born? Standing around in a hospital room, I know that.
Well, they were divorced, for one thing. What was my mom doing?
Yeah.
I think she was recovering from her divorce.
And your father was his occupation?
He was a musician, classical musician.
Was he, what was he?
Harmony and composition.
Private or with an institution?
He worked for, he was at Northwestern University. In Evanston, Illinois, and then I think just around the beginning of the war, they moved out to California in the Redwood Country, and he was just composing out there.
Did you go to high school in Concord?
No, no. After I was born, my mom moved out to Wyoming in 1947, I believe. Bought a farm there, right outside Sheridan, Wyoming. And in 1954, they bought a ranch in southeastern Montana. I went to high school in Sheridan, Wyoming.
In Sheridan, Wyoming.
It was the closest across the line.
And what was the name of the high school?
Sheridan. High school.
Well, I've been there. It's you know, it's down the block from God, you know, up on the plateau there.
Right.
It's pretty nice. Is a good question to ask. That did you ever have any inkling that you would be interested in, like, humanitarian help?
Well, when I was in high school, it was much. It was like the film American Graffiti.
Uh-huh.
That's how we grew up. It was cars and beer and chasing girls. That whole bag, right? That was pretty much high school. Not serious about much of anything. And, you know, the civil rights movement was growing steam. And so that, even though out in Sheridan, I think there was one black family in the whole community, that started to have an impact. Just things and injustice and all that stuff. So it was kind of the pre-60s. Although that was sort of my first impulse towards doing something about the state of the world.
Well, you know, it's interesting because obviously, actually, we're thinking of a world or things that are greater than yourself. You know, people don't have it. Did you think that did your mother have any influence on that, or your friends at school, or it's something you?
See, you have to start off with the fact that my mother is from a. Old New England family. My grandmother was a Quaker. My grandfather was a colonel in the military, in the army. I'm sure that comes down to you in some way or another. Mother was never an activist in any sense of the word, but a very strong sense of morality and, you know, that sort of bubbled up, I think, to the surface.
Was she a practicing Quaker when you were growing up?
No, my grandmother was a Quaker.
But your mother was?
My mother was nothing.
Nothing.
She was a, probably as close to an animist as you can be. A pantheist.
A pantheist.
Or something, you know, nature.
Uh-huh. But she wasn't part of an organized church.
No.
Did you see much of your father in those years?
Pretty much only once. We took a trip to Canada. My mother died in, I don't know, I'm not even sure, in the 50s, late 50s sometime.
What did your stepfather
do? My father was a laborer. He had a fourth grade education. He was, you know, a strong, virile type of guy.
But your mom liked him, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did you go to college in after you graduated high school?
Went for a couple semesters at a couple local community colleges, one in Sheridan and one in Miles City, Montana. At the time, I was a drummer in a rock and roll band. And with my brother and two friends, we formed a rock and roll band, and we were kind of the first in northern Wyoming, the Infernals, that was our name.
And you had your own, were you the manager of the band as well?
No, I was just a drummer. My brother was kind of the manager. And then we went down to Denver as a band, and there for about a year, various bars and places. Of course, Colorado has a 3-2 beer law, so 18-year-olds had their own clubs. And then we trekked to Salt Lake City because our lead guitar player had moved there. He'd married and so on. And to a point where we just decided to split up, and I decided to stay and go to college at University of Utah. History from my high school and what kind of college days. When I was at Utah, I had a very good Vietnamese friend. And we were friends, and so I kind of got into the whole Vietnam situation, which was, we're talking here about 1961, 62. And the news from Vietnam was kept getting more and more intense all the time. So that got my interest in Vietnam stoked up a lot. And, by around the time about 1963, which was kind of a watershed year, that was when Diem was overthrown and killed, and his brother, and not long after Kennedy was killed. It was the coup season set in Saigon, and it was kind of a preview of the early 70s, kind of, but without the sort of new left and all that, and that was yet to come. But in any case, by 1963, I'd already decided I wanted to go into something like the Peace Corps anyway, because I was interested in things like anthropology, kind of sense, and you know, there's a whole world out there to look at and experience. And between that and sort of my good Vietnamese friend, it just sort of coalesced, and he was the one that first told me about IDS as an alternative to the military.
How did he know about IDS?
Good question.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure. I think he had met some IDSers in Vietnam before he'd come over. Because, of course, they'd been there since 1954.
Yeah.
But he was just hooked up to the whole, you know, at that time, there were quite a few Vietnamese students in America, and I'm sure before the internet, they were connected in various ways.
Did he actually suggest, I mean, was he the first person from whom you heard the name IBM?
Yeah. And at that point, frankly, I was in kind of a quandary because there was a war going on in Vietnam, and mission in America, of course, there was a draft, and it was just accepted that males would just go into the service, would either be drafted or enlist and serve for 4 years. And if you believe that what we were doing in Vietnam around between 62 and 64 was right, there was a war going on. It was still pretty much advisors, military advisors. You had to ask yourself, well, if I believe in this, am I willing to go fight for it? Or was the nature of this particular conflict such that you would serve everybody better by going into an organization like IVS? And I puzzled about this for a long time, and then I finally decided to go into IVS.
Were you concerned about the draft as draft? You know, that if you didn't find something else, it was likely you would be drafted. And you might find yourself in Vietnam, you might not. Was that at all a motivation or a concern?
Not really, no. Because if I had gone into the military at that time, I would have volunteered to go to Vietnam. Already Vietnam was...
You wanted to go to Vietnam.
I wanted to go to Vietnam.
Right.
And one way or the other, I'd already decided that. And so it wasn't... You know, I don't consider myself a military person. I don't have the right mentality for that. Partly because, as I mentioned, my grandfather was a colonel. And, you know, I have relatives who I suppose people would call militarists. And it's not a question of escaping the draft or getting out of the military. It was really tough. What can I do that fits all these different pieces together in the best way for me and for Vietnam, and just kind of, you know, for the world in general? This was still the Kennedy era, you know, when people were thinking in these very idealistic terms, very real at the time. I mean, the Peace Corps was still a very strong option for people. There was a lot less kind of careerism and getting ahead. It was more like take out a couple years and go serve humanity in your country, that sort of thing. It appealed to me.
Did you apply for the Peace Corps, by the way?
No, because the Peace Corps wasn't in Vietnam.
That's the whole point. I mean, there wouldn't have been IVS. Well, anyway, so did you write a letter of application to IVS?
Well, let me see. It must have been about 65 when I first wrote them. I'm not quite sure about the dates, but along about in there, when I knew I was going to graduate, I was studying philosophy. That's what I graduated in. And I knew that I was expediting my college life because I was going to summer school. So I was basically going to school full time. And of course, the situation in Vietnam kept escalating and kept getting more bizarre. And I just wanted to get out into the world. And, I remember almost the last philosophy course I took was the philosophy of history. At the time, of course, you read philosophy for 3 or 4 years, and it's all very abstract, and, you know, you're talking about red dots, and how do we perceive a red as opposed to something green or something like that. And it gets a little cut off from things. There's a lot of political stirring going on in the world. So I really wanted to just finish up and get out into the world. And I expedited my college career, and I graduated in 66, and I was signed up. And basically, after about 2 months of sitting around home, I left.
Were you interviewed by anyone from IVS?
Yeah, once. Told me the guy's name, I remember it. He had been an agricultural worker in Vietnam, and he was on the staff. I had a dinner interview with him at the Salt Lake City Airport.
Then, what you were going to do with him in agricultural?
Well, that wasn't determined at the time I applied, of course, but at that point, point, right in that era, IVS was expanding its community development team
a lot.
And partly because of pressure from the USAID people and so on, because they wanted more warm bodies over there. So it was kind of up in the air. I did not want to be just an English teacher. I think I made that pretty clear. I didn't feel really, even though I'd grown up on a ranch in an agricultural environment, I really didn't feel that I had the knowledge and background of agriculture. It was something I prefer to dabble in, kind of. Mm-hmm. But the community development thing was general enough, and you didn't know what the hell it was. So that was where I was headed for. And that's pretty much describes how I wanted to. I was doing mostly community development, but I did some teaching English.
Did you go to? I'm just trying to figure. Did you go to Washington D.C. before you went to Vietnam for orientation? Did you go to Harpers Ferry?
Yep. I went to. This must have been, I keep thinking June of 1966, so whether it was just, I went there in May or it was June, you know, it was right around that area. First night I got in Washington, of course I'd been back east a lot, but I'd never been in Washington. And the first other IVSer I met was Bob Minnick. He's been a close friend of mine now ever since. And we just sort of hit it. And then we were in Washington, and we had the State Department briefing.
What'd you think of that? You might actually remember it. A lot of people don't remember the briefing at all.
I remember the briefing mainly because this gentleman got up and gave us an anti-communist lecture. And one of his little techniques was he would hiss when he would say communists. Mm-hmm. So he would make them sound really sinister. And it was just classical 50s anti-communist rhetoric. And I had found, you know, after McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee and all that stuff, it fell like a leaden balloon. And I remember Mark Lynch got up. And of course he was this very astute politically, recent graduate from Yale. So he had all that. And he stood up and he just read that guy the Riot Act and just said it was the worst presentation he'd ever heard. And he just raked this guy, and most of us thought this was great because it was pathetic. It was like they were treating us like, you know, innocents, that we could get this sort of Yale standard early 50s anti-communist drummed into our head and then go off to Vietnam and do good works. And it was just such a, there was just a gap between where we most of us were coming from and this kind of mindset. But I mean, it wasn't like this was the end of the world or anything. It was just a kind of I suppose for most of us, it was the first time we'd ever heard somebody from the State Department, you know, tell us what American policy was all about or something like that. It was just one little blip. And then Harper's Ferry was a totally different thing altogether. Pretty much more of a social getting together and changing identities and all that kind of stuff.
Do you find it useful enough for that?
Yeah, I mean. And you would kind of find people you had affinities with, and you would find people who struck you very much the wrong way, were quite abrasive. But, you know, IBS has always been a collocation of individuals, kind of very loosely bound together by the organization. And that was the way it was there, and it was kind of cool.
Do you remember who was in your client, I mean, at Harper's Ferry, any of the IBSers you later knew?
Oh, well, Bob Minnick was certainly there, of course. And if I were to have to sit here and list them, I probably couldn't. Because it was kind of staggered. See, at this point, IBS was really drawing in a lot of people. So I know people who were sort of in my same year, but the very same class.
Because you're a community development worker, did you go to Los Banos?
Good. Two-month-old experience there was the fields, and then the guy would come with his caribou bow. They say it differently in the Philippines.
But a water buffalo.
Right, a water buffalo. And they would show us how they plant rice at the Rice Institute there. And for some reason, I sort of made friends with this plowboy. And he took me to his house and introduced me to his wife and his kids. And we felt kind of good because I was the only one of the IBSers that sort of had developed solidarity with an Asian. And it, you know, basically the first Asian, except for my friends in college, who I'd ever really run into. He took me to the movies, and it turned out to be one of these soft porn things. Just dreadful. And, you know, you could barely see the screen. It was so dark. But it was just brass that I had here. I really didn't know what to think about it. But, it was kind of fun. As for really learning anything at Los Baños, it was more getting acclimatized to the heat, which was dreadful, and bad food, which was very dreadful, and just there were a lot of the agricultural students eventually showed up there, and they were youth, actually, most of them. Although we had a couple Filipinos that joined our team there. We're both very. It was just being in a real alien environment and not necessarily being thought of as wonderful people, but being sort of the target of some suspicion and some resentment. And it was kind of being plunged a little bit into that alien environment, being an outsider. And most of us, by the way, or at least a small coterie of us, found this little cafe, this little Chinese cafe in the city of Los Baños, the town of Los Baños. I think it was a Hong Kong cafe, which had pretty good Chinese food and very cold San Miguel beer. So that became our hang. Also, they had Beatles on the jukebox. So that became kind of our hangout, because the food that we had at the university there was just dreadful. So we became this kind of cluster, I suppose you could call us ugly Americans, sitting around drinking San Miguel and listening to the Beatles, and not being obnoxious, but that also showed you another little aspect of how easy it was to kind of clump together and not interact with local people. But on the other hand, in our favor, or in our justification, I guess, this time most of us had been exposed to a really quite different culture. And well, I don't think we offended people that much, but you know, it wasn't people to people.
Well, was it a good halfway house? I mean, was it a good, not so much a good preparation technically, because obviously it wasn't a good preparation technically for what you were going to do. But.
I think so. Although, you know, Filipinos are very different people from the Vietnamese. And that's one thing that Asians is that, number one, they tend not to like each other, these various cultures, and they're really quite different, although there is kind of an umbrella Asia culture, which is the same from India to Korea to Japan. I think it was kind of crossing a threshold, but of course it wasn't really real either, because there wasn't a war going on, and the academic setting, it was the Rice Institute setting, mm-hmm. So it was a different bag of things that we were going to be. It was a good icebreaker.
Then you flew to Vietnam directly from Manila? I mean, to Saigon?
Yeah.
And do you have any first impression when you arrived at the airport?
Well, the first impression I had was when the captain of the airplane announced there was land. And we all rushed over to the side of the plane when you could see land. I'm sure the plane must have tipped over about 45 degrees. Just to see down there that there was a country named Vietnam, a real actual entity instead of something you've been reading about in the papers for the past 5 years. And it was kind of just this euphoria of expectation, I guess. And in Saigon, well, you came into Saigon, Tan Chin Yeo, and got instruction, you know, no photographs and no cameras. And then the nearer you got, the more you saw this extraordinary military array of aircraft and helicopters buzzing around. That was, again, for most of us, we'd never seen anything like that before, a war zone. And then when the door opened, this blast of tropic heat just hit you. And so you're coming out of this air-conditioned cabin of the airplane and all expecting to see this great, fabulous world of Vietnam, and suddenly you're hit with this wilting blast of tropical air, just so damn hot. And it puts your mind in kind of a polarized state, you know. IDF's house was very close to Tan Chin Yeo Airport. I think it was about 3 miles from there. Maybe even home. And within an hour after arriving, we were at the IDF's compound, and which was fairly cool compared to just, and you know, that was kind of a normalizing thing to do, out and drink a few beers and kind of just stick around for 3 or 4 days just to get used to the climate, because that took some doing. I remember, though, about the second night I was in Saigon, a couple of the old-time IVSers took me downtown with me and a couple other guys, and we were all going to go eat, and they decided they needed pizza. So the first meal I had in a restaurant in Vietnam was pizza. And I was very chagrined by this. I thought that was just awful.
Were given your assignment, or where did you go to some language training?
We went to language training. I was in a group that went to Metaw down in the Delta. I don't know, there must have been about M-Y-T-H-O.
T-H-O.
Right, two words. There were about 15 of us, I think, and we had 6 months. I had already studied Vietnamese before I left the States, a friend of my friend, my Vietnamese friend at the University of Utah, was he was a captain in the Vietnamese Army and a medical doctor. And he was doing some graduate work. I enlisted him to help me study Vietnamese. I had the tones down, and you know, I it got me a little bit ahead of the others, but I tried to get out of language training, and Don Luce came down and started talking to me in Vietnamese, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying, so he wouldn't let me cut out of language training. Rightly so. That again was, it was hard because you want to get out and start doing stuff. And you're sitting in a hot house all day, you know, doing these repetitious language drills, and it just drives you nuts. And then you go out to the marketplace and actually try to speak with somebody. And of course they're talking in you know, fast and kind of slang and very informal Vietnamese. And all your language training doesn't seem to have any connection. You can get out, you know, how are you, and that sort of stuff. But to actually carry on a conversation or a simple transaction.
So you found out that your language skills were coming along slower than you hoped, because you wanted to get out.
Well, learning a language like Vietnamese takes quite a bit of time. In fact, the rule of thumb was that you had to be in the country for a year before you really, I guess that's very true. And this is, I'm sure this is common to volunteers and missionaries and everybody who's ever gone out to a fairly remote or you know, culture that's distant from their own and tried to learn a quite different language. And it's a constant frustration, because the thing you want to do right away is to understand what's going on in those hearts and minds of people, and you don't have the wherewithal to do it, and especially in rural Vietnam, it was Vietnamese or nothing. In Saigon and some of the bigger cities, people that knew French could get by. I didn't know French either, so and speaking French was considered sort of not what one wanted to be doing in Vietnam. So.
Your assignment to the place where you were going to be?
Yeah. Well, I think there was some. I think I was one of these people that was hard to place. High risk, possibly high gain type of person. Had it set in my mind that I really wanted to be in the Delta, the Mekong Delta. And by that point, I'd known about the Hua Hao Buddhist, and that sounded to me exactly the kind of people I wanted to be around and work with.
Oh, that's Hua Hao, that's H-A-O-H-O-A.
No, it's H-O-A-H-A-O.
A-O.
Hua Hao, it means peace. Mm-hmm. I think they were thinking about putting me more of a refugee situation with Catholic relief agencies, and At that point, having just graduated in philosophy, I was kind of arrogantly anti-religious. And I had been in Utah for 4 years, and I'd been around the Mormons, and really didn't want to, but it sounds bad or prejudiced now, to me anyway. I think I would have been very unhappy in that situation. And friends who did get that particular assignment did not find it to his liking at all. Anyway, I kind of tipped the balance, and they decided to send me down to SEDEC. At that point was it was the northern half of Binglong Province. And about a year later, it became a separate province. A couple days before President Diem's brother had changed it all around for legal reasons. But what became the provincial capital of SEDEC City. And I was established out in a village about 12 kilometers away called Hualong, which means dragon. Probably means happy dragon or something like that. Dragons, close enough. It was the district capital. And that's where I got set up.
Did it have a military compound?
It did. It had the district advisors of MACV, which of course is Assistance Command Vietnam. There were, every district capital had a group of American military advisors, usually with a captain or a major in charge, and about five, there's usually then a lieutenant, and then four or five enlisted people, privates. And I did, I had to stay with these folks for about, I guess at least a month, in their hooch. The military kind of used it generically. It's sort of just a temporary. And frankly, I found it very difficult. Because I had made my choice not to go in the military. And in a sense, here I was kind of stuck and living with it. Home with all of them fine, and they were okay. Frustrating, and they would try, just in the very structure of the situation, the captain would try to shape what I was doing and try to get me kind of involved in his outlook and his projects. And in a sense, he even kind of, he didn't have a lieutenant with him. So he, in a way, kind of adopted me as kind of a surrogate lieutenant in a strange, strange way. And it was hard to get out from under that. I mean, he would tell me things that he wouldn't tell, the sergeant or the privates, the specialist. And he would always want me to go out with him. One night he took me out it was a propaganda troop that had gone to one of the hamlets. And he decided it would be a great idea to see how these people actually functioned out in the hamlet instead of just hearing about it. Well, one didn't go out at night. Even in the secure areas, especially in the Jeep, because that just blared out officer. So it was good target. I went with him anyway, and we went out there and saw this propaganda troop, and then we drove back, and he got the Jeep stuck. So we were sitting there out in this hamlet, and all of a sudden these kind of black shapes just kind of came in on both sides of us. And there was just the villagers, wearing their black their albabog, you know, their peasant clothes. And about eight of them got behind the Jeep and pushed and pulled the way they do and got us out, and we went on our merry way. But, you know, it was kind of, the night in Vietnam was very spooky. And, you know, both the Viet Cong and the peasants all wore, you know, the black garb, and it could have been anybody. But that was kind of the, you know, I wanted to distance myself from that politicized tincture. At the same time, I was extraordinarily curious about all this stuff. I wanted to see what a propaganda troop was doing and what. They just got up and sang their songs and spouted out their propaganda. And, it was kind of, all this stuff has its ancestry back in the Viet Minh days. So the propaganda on both sides was pretty much the same, except, you know, you change.
Did they evoke Vietnamese heroes of the past?
Well, at this point,
I know that's. I thought of that before I asked that question.
My Vietnamese went. I really didn't know what the. You know, I could hear them say, "Down with communism," or "Up with the nation," or whatever. I'm sure they did, because that's standard, standard procedure. Just kind of mention that because it was very striking for me to be out there in this night, but also just to kind of contradictions and matters of judgment you had to deal with. At that point, the IVS team was growing, partly because of American pressure on it to grow. People were getting put into some very insecure areas. And I know some other volunteers that came a little later than me, you know, spent at least a year living with U.S. military folks. I was lucky because my district was considered secure enough that I got permission to go live in the village, which is across the little river. It made me put in a telephone link. But I considered that to be a reasonable compromise, because I had to take into consideration that these folks were getting pressure from their superiors, and the last thing they needed was to have a dead young American civilian on their career chart.
That's true.
And so you just had to balance these things off against each other, and that made it. It made everything kind of compromised in one sense, but it also, after time, you kind of worked out your modus operandi. And they were actually pretty good about not, you know, as long as I didn't go crazy and try to go out into really bad areas. But I had a Lambretta scooter, so I had my own motation. So if they knew I'd tell them where I was going, and I wouldn't push my luck, and they pretty much let me do my thing. And sometimes you just had to rely on their transportation because that was the only way you could get to places, and you couldn't go to certain places without a bunch of guards going down the river, the branch of the Mekong. We would go down on the little sampans, and you essentially just had to have security along with you, or you didn't go. And that's just the way it was. I generally elected to try to work in the secure areas where I could get to by myself. But once in a while, I would travel down with the advisor team to go to places I hadn't been and just see if I could offer a little bit of something, you know, given we had these agriculture magazines and things like that, just to kind of let them know that they weren't totally forgotten and cut off from the rest of the world. One of the things about this whole situation was that he essentially had to work in secure areas. That means areas you could go out in the daylight without being armed and by yourself without getting shot at. We all had our little mechanisms. Usually I would check with little tea sellers along the road, and I got to be friendly with kind of very strategic people like that, civilians. And you just say, well, how's the road today? And if they say, well, I don't think I'd go down that if I were you, you kind of tend to change your plans for that day. But this was not per se politics or an ideological thing. It was just simply to do any kind of sustained work anywhere, there has to be a certain minimum of security. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just incontestable. And I used to say to people, I used to get people angry at me, but I'd say, you know, in this kind of situation, which is kind of a civil war, you have to work on one side or the other. There's a Vietnamese expression, this side, that side. Ben Nai, Ben Kia. And I just said, you know, we're here, we're on this side. And to do any kind of work, we have to be. That's partly, that reflected some of my own political sentiments at the time. But I think it was sometimes construed that way more than I wanted to be. That's one of the main tensions and conflicts you have to deal with working in a war zone, doing civilian work in a war zone. No, and it would have been the same if we'd been on the other side. We would have had to work in their secure areas. And I used to say about IVS that, yes, we're working with people on one side of the fence, although God knows their affiliations and allegiances were far murkier than most of us even thought about or dreamed about. Our mission there in IVS was to do work that would remain after we left and still have an impact no matter who won the war. And no matter which side you were on or how you tried to hedge or whatever, I still think that was the IVS mission. I'm getting off into theme of you're not asking about.
There's one of the issues was that, I mean, this is very typical actually. Community development workers tried very hard to be as distant from the local military combat. Always dependent for transportation. They're isolated to that. But what work were you doing in these areas?
Well, I started off sort of going around with the agricultural agents of the government, the cadre, as everybody called them. Again, this is one of these old Viet Minh terms that came down to everybody. And we were trying to get people interested in growing watermelons and secondary crops on the off season, so they would have something besides just rice. cultivation. And I just kind of tagged along, and once in a while I'd manage to get some seeds and give them to the agricultural guy and get magazines to hand out. And it was sort of just a sidekick role, you know, kind of a morale boosting. And sometimes transportation, I'd give the cadre a ride somewhere they couldn't get to easily. And right from the beginning, the IVSer who had been there before Jim Lynn, he had been the IVS rep in Binglong Province, and he had cultivated a wide variety of contacts throughout the province. And he was an agriculture guy, so that was kind of his main thing. And he hooked me up with the leader of the Waha Buddhists in one of the villages, Duktan. I can't even remember the name of the village yet. But, so I hooked up with him very early on, the leader. And he would of course, was very disappointed because my Vietnamese was so poor, as opposed to Jim Lin's. Jim spoke very excellent Vietnamese, especially agricultural terms and all that sort of stuff. So Mr. Day is his name, D-A-Y, would laboriously write out all these little requests and questions, and then I would head back to my place, and I'd laboriously get out a dictionary and translate all this stuff and try to figure out what the hell he'd been asking me about. And, you know, minor requests for some seeds or why is this fertilizer agent taking a big cut off, you know, a surcharge on fertilizer when it was supposed to be sold for cost. And Waha, of course, we're in a very prickly relationship with the central government. And they trusted the IVSers a lot. They trusted the Americans a lot, the Waha as a whole. And of course, the Americans, the government people, thought the Waha were great allies in the struggle, and they were. They were kind of homespun warlord type folks, some of them, and they were progressive. They wanted to learn new techniques, agriculture, and they were willing to try new things, and so they were really kind of an ideal group to deal with. Unfortunately, because of their tension with the government, trying to get anything that smacked of political power or favoritism for them immediately created these vast hang-ups. About during my second year, the local Waha wanted to set up farmers associations, which were essentially co-ops, to buy fertilizer and seed and pumps for defoliant, what do you call it?
Insecticide,
things like that. They had these little pumps you strapped in your back. And, you know, they were too expensive for an individual farmer to buy, but as a collective thing, they made a lot of sense. And of course, the Waha had their own social structure kind of behind it that would have, it's the old story in Vietnam, parallel hierarchies. National Liberation Front had their hierarchy, which was parallel to the government hierarchy, and the various religious and other political groups all had their own hierarchies. And certainly the Waha had theirs. So it was quite obvious that the Farmers Association and these Wahao villages was going to be dominated by the Wahao leadership. Essentially, parallel leadership structures. Now, even though the government was ostensibly encouraging these farmers associations on the national, regional, and local levels, they in fact were dragging their feet. At least in my area, because of the Wahao connection. And also, I think at that point, they were scared about any center of power that wasn't directly dominated by the central government.
Well, excluding the Wahao areas, how would they lose authority by providing agricultural assistance in another area?
Well, you have to sort of think Asian on that one. Any center of competing power is a threat to your own power. Any hierarchy, any institution that can diminish your own authority or legitimacy or power is a threat.
Well, are you saying any farmers cooperative therefore represented a source of demand to the government?
No, I don't think so much. It was just a competing center of power.
That is the local
right
distributors of aid.
Right, and it was anything that was not under the direct control of the whole government apparatus, and that theoretically created loyalty by going through this apparatus, was just perceived as a threat. I mean, it's kind of a zero-sum mentality. Mm-hmm. If you have power, then you're taking that power away from me. Mm-hmm. And given that the Wahaos have this history of sectarianism and regionalism and so on and so forth, I mean, it wasn't totally, you know, phantasmagorical idea. But anyway, on every single level, we started out on the local level, and I tried to help them with all the paperwork, and I was talking with the USAID people all the time, and they were all for this, of course, and so they were doing their best to expedite things. And then we kind of went up to the provincial level. And then we kept getting roadblocks, so I went down to the regional level, because in Vietnam, which has this very French bureaucratic structure, there are about 8 layers between everything and the central government. And it's a very wonderful Platonic Cartesian system in theory, if you look on a organization chart or power, you know, flow chart or something. But in practice, it means that every single node in that chart is also a possible constriction point, a bottleneck. For whatever reasons, are sort of lost in the mists of Saigon. So after fighting this for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months on the local level, I went up to the national level. There was a Farmers Association national level. And I interceded on that level with input, you know, from various other folks, and all the documentation in order, the voluminous documentation, all very bureaucratic, and still nothing. So at that point, I think the leadership of the Wahao, it finally dawned on them that this was just a hopeless cause, and they just abandoned their effort. But I think I spent a good part of 3 months just dealing with this.
What was the program that they were trying to get extended?
Just to get recognition as a farmers association. on kind of a province-wide basis, mm-hmm. at least with, you know, the Wahao territory. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those programs, I'm sure the American government was pushing it, and I, you know, all the American advisors, aid advisors that I dealt with were in favor of it and helped me as much as they could. But eventually it just was a political dead end. And that was the kind of thing you kind of dealt with, and as a low-level volunteer, there wasn't really a hell of a lot you could do about it in the final analysis. It was really, ultimately, it was, insofar as the American government had any influence on the Vietnamese government, it was a government-to-government thing, you know. Either you go ahead with this program and we'll give you money for it, or not. And of course, what probably happened, they probably gave him money for it anyway, and it just
evaporated.
Sand, you know, water into the sand, like a lot of other programs. I would like to. I think you asked this on your questionnaire. I think the quality of the USAID people down where I worked anyway was extremely high. They were good people. Most of them were former Peace Corps people. Many from had been in Latin America, which let them speak Spanish with each other among the Vietnamese, so the Vietnamese couldn't understand when they had some sensitive personnel matters to deal with. For the most part, they were, you know, they were more of a help than a hindrance to my work. Mm-hmm. And they weren't trying to tell you what to do or how you should do it. And, you know, there wasn't a real political dimension to it, as you might think there was. I mean, basically, they were trying to do the same thing that we were doing, except they had a lot more money and materiel and assistance and translators and just this vast apparatus, and also they had these vast bureaucratic pressures on them to produce results. And the first American I knew in Vietnam who was killed was a guy named Fred Abramson, a former Peace Corps guy, and he was acting province advisor at the time, and he told me, he said, you know,